Chase Burns, landowner, land broker, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, president of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, director of conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska director of science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, founder of Sacred Seed.
Ryan Bryson with Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritsch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meachin.
And you are listening to the Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast. Chase, good to see you again, buddy. I got a burning question here for you. Can you summarize what on earth has been going on with the land market over the last calendar year?
In 10 words.
No. No, I can't. It's going to take us a minute to cover that. So the land market, most people know, real estate in general just went bonkers after mid 2020. There was a little bit longer lull period after, you know, the pandemic stuff first hit for residential market, but with raw land, rural homes and acreages, things like that, it only lasted about 6 weeks here. So,
wow. Really?
Yeah.
Within, so who lost? Sorry.
Go ahead.
Who lost in that? Because if value skyrockets and then plummets, someone has to lose that depreciation.
It hasn't plummeted. I mean, So what could happen, I suppose, if the recession really started to bite and we had huge widespread job losses, something like that, we would see a softening in the market. But as of right now, and I'll get to that, but the market really has not turned downward in the rural residential real estate market. It has somewhat in the residential world, and then especially in like the hotbeds, the Colorados and Arizonas and different places where the market went totally ridiculous and everything was selling for 40, 50, 60,000 over asking and that kind of stuff. Yeah. Okay. That came down, but we never had that, you know, not in Illinois anywhere in the parts of Illinois that I sell in. So rural real estate market really, really took off. We saw on Class A and B farm ground, we saw appreciation gains in the 14 to 20, 21% range. Whoa. For 21 or for, excuse me, for FY 21, 22 and the first half of 23.
What is Class A B?
Class A would be, so in Illinois, we use a really ridiculous system. Our CSR in Iowa makes so much more sense than what we use. But we use a productivity index scale that tops out at 147.
Okay.
So from like 133 to 147 is Class A, which would be like exceptionally good farmland. For 132 and down to into like the 119 range is Class B, and then 119 and under, you know, gets into Class C stuff. So it's just a scale that was developed, you know, a long time ago, and maybe the 30s or 40s or 50s at the maybe most recently. I'm not exactly sure on the history of that, but it's kind of like, you know, why do we use 12 inches in a foot instead of using something that makes sense like metric? Well, it's because we didn't come up with the idea, so we don't like it. So the land market for good quality farmland, let's say Class B, high Class C stuff, low Class B, it's a little bit softer. It has been through that whole period of time, but still some huge gains. You know, 40-year outlook on Class A and Class B farm ground would be somewhere around 10.5% to 13% annually appreciation on that, on like really, really good quality stuff. It has gained consistently at that level. There've been
10%.
There've been only a couple of years where it was in the negative, and only a handful of years where it was like low single digits, 3% to 6%.
That well outperforms the S&P 500.
And nobody talks about that.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So, and especially when you couple in, you know, people generally, when they think, oh gosh, you couldn't talk me into taking money out of my retirement fund to go buy a piece of farmland because I'm making 12 or 13% here, you know, and if I put it there, I'm going to make 2.5, you know, three and a quarter if I'm doing well. And, but they're only looking at the cash flow that it generates annually instead of the appreciation of the value of the land going up over time. So we had a few, you know, a few different land classes there that gained at variable rates. Class C, actually like low quality farmland, last year and the year before in Illinois gained at a lower percentage rate of appreciation than recreational land did. So it was still, it was like 4.5 to 7%, and recreational land was gaining at like 8 to 9.5%. So there's, you know, the thing is the lower quality farmland and recreational, like mixed tracts, 50-50 type parcels and stuff is just more volatile. So you'll have some peak periods where people really get excited about buying rec ground, and especially like it, recreational land is more like the fine art market. When people are making a lot of money somewhere, they'll pay top dollar for something that they get excited about. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully it appreciates over time. But if we end up in a major recession or a big economic crunch, or the stock market drops a third in a, you know, 5-day period or something, then all of a sudden that market just drops because those people are not interested in spending money on something that doesn't make them money when they're losing money somewhere else.
Well, there's a small percentage of the population that's spending $200,000 on recreation, you know what I mean, on recreational land, as opposed to someone who would buy money to turn it into a cash flow. That's a much broader market, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think most people, every time I post a recreational property to social media, it's inevitable that like you'll get a little bit of hate, or people throw a little bit of shade and say, oh, that's crazy high price, nobody can afford that.
And must be nice.
Then it sells within a week or less a lot of times. And it's, I think that's not a dig at those folks necessarily. It's just that they have a very small vision of the economic outlook in the world. And there's so much more money out there than most people realize.
Why do you think the boom in real estate was related to the handout money, the
COVID money, the
money? Sure.
It like got pooled, you know, it pooled into some areas, and those people ended up spending on land.
So what most of us don't know about, or don't hear much about, is like we all think of, you know, the PPP money, or, you know, the payments that some small business owners got and stuff, that, oh, you know, they might have got, you know, $12,000 or $20,000 or something that at the end of a year they could, you know, a forgivable loan type of things. Mm-hmm. People, most common folks heard about plenty of those. Now, maybe they got one, or maybe they just know at least a couple of people that did. But everybody knows, you know, okay, first payment, first round of, you know, handout money was what, $1,600 or something. And it's, nobody's buying a farm, you know, with those small amounts of cash. But where those things really compounded was, I didn't realize this honestly for like the first year and a half into the pandemic. I wasn't fully aware what happens with the people that have a company that has 200 plus employees. Like, how much money did they get? And it was a ridiculous amount of money that was handed to them and then was forgiven.
Yeah. The idea was they couldn't let anybody go, right? And if they could keep everyone on, then they...
If they retained X number of employees, they were eligible for this payment back. And in theory, it was like, the idea was, well, they're putting this money out there to stimulate the economy. And I'm not an economist, disclaimer. So like, if I'm saying something that doesn't make financial sense, somebody can just kind of say, well, I have limited understanding of how this worked, but I do have exposure to it through a number of buyer clients and people that would call me and say like, hey, I got about $1.6 million that I'm looking to stick in a farm right now. And I'm like, cool, great. What, did you sell another farm? I'm, you know, just making conversation and kind of trying to learn a little bit more about what's driving the market. And because a lot of times when somebody has a big chunk of money like that, it's a 1031. They're rolling it out of one farm sale into another. And they're like, no, I just money from the business, you know. And finally, I started to have a little bit more in-depth conversations with a few, and they would tell me what happened and how much money they received from it in the first wave. And, well, the first wave, we bought a condo, or we bought a beach house in Florida. And the second wave, we're looking to buy, you know, a farm that's somewhere here in this part. And it was like, whoa, like that's real money that was... You know, I don't think that's necessarily what the government had intended it to be used for.
Right.
But they're able to use it for that. They can use it for whatever they want. I mean, the reality is that they held on to employees through, you know, a pretty shaky time in, you know, the business market. And good on them for being able to do that. And honestly, I mean, they weren't told that was going to happen ahead of time. It's almost like a reward that was given. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's those are head scratcher things, because I have a good friend who talks about this with other government money that's extended, and especially when it comes to buying land, you show up to an auction and he talks about bidding against your own tax dollars. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And
I've heard that expression before.
Yeah, it's a good point, you know. It's like, you know, it's part of the game, you know. Yeah. But you know, if you can't beat them, join them. You know, find a way to put yourself in a position to.
I don't want to give anybody the impression, though, that that's really what's driving the market, because those are, like you said earlier, that's such a small portion of the people out there who have that kind of wealth or that control a company of that size or whatever. The vast majority of the market rally was because people really wanted to be in the country. When you're watching on the news every day about just unrest in most of the cities and a little bit more uncertainty. And then that compounded with the effect of everybody told, go home, work from home. We'll figure this out. Well, okay. After doing that for 6 months or a year, and it's like, you mean I don't have to come into an office any day? Mm. I don't have to live in the suburbs so that I'm within a 15-minute drive of work. I can go move out an hour and a half and live on my farm and work the same job. Basically, if you have high-speed internet, you could work from just about anywhere.
Yeah.
When they made that change, that was a big shift that brought a lot of rural buyers into the market.
Yeah.
Any property we listed that had fiber or had high-speed internet, you know, that it could be a pretty remote property, and it opened up a whole new pool of buyers.
Yeah.
Because what happened in exchange with that is commercial real estate in cities crashed really hard. Not crashed as in like an economic crash, but it really took a dip. And
for sure.
And now we're coming up on properties that were at a peak in 2020, and they're in a couple of years, they're going to have their rates adjusted. It'll be the 5-year rate adjustment. And a lot of them don't have the renters, the commercial office space rented out enough to be able to handle the jump from 3.95% to 7%. Which for that company, for a big commercial building, could be a $10 million check difference.
Yeah.
Sorry, we don't normally get into like...
No, it's good. This is Nick's...
That really escalated.
Yeah. this is what I think about. Problem. Like when I lay awake at night, I think about like real estate...
that there could be a lot of bankruptcies, you know, when that happens. But most of those businesses they're just shill. You know, organizations, because at this point they might go bankrupt because of a lease that they tied into that is no longer affordable to them on like a very expensive piece of commercial real estate, but they're likely just going to change over their payroll. they're probably not going to have like mass layoffs or whatever, because they've already done that. Like they've already adapted
and
still have those employees retained. Mm-hmm. They're just working from home now. They just don't need the overhead that they had before.
Yeah.
I know you're officially not an economist, but you obviously have a big brain. You've got an education at least through back alleyways, if not formally. But what's really interesting is you also take care of cattle and horses, you know, during the day. I think that's so cool.
Just going back to Nick's big brain comment, we actually gave Chase a snapback hat last time we did this podcast, and it broke right on the back.
Classic big brain move.
Lasted about a week.
I'm just too hard on it. I can't have nice things.
No, it's good. It was a good conversation to talk about that. And you know, there's different takeaways that are hidden in there, I'm sure, but it is what it is. It's part of this. It's the fabric of the story, right? But it's been over a year. I think we were here in January last time, so a little bit over a year since we were last here, and a lot changes in a year.
Mm-hmm.
This is the third time I've been in your office, and it's been rearranged three times. So,
that's every week.
But it's
a modular type of space. We use it for a lot of different things. So recording podcasts, now that we're doing that too, every other week seems like we change how things are laid out in here. And it's nice to have a space that you can do that with. But
it's super usable.
No, I'm so glad you guys came back out. It was a lot of fun having you out the first time, and I kind of, since you mentioned it to me a while ago, you're like, would you want to do it again? I was like,
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it was a lot of fun. Your voice is a part of our intro montage. You'll have to listen in there. There's bits of all kinds of guests that we've had in there, and your voice makes it in there.
Until you find somebody better.
I don't know. It took me so long to edit that montage. It might be there for a really long time.
Yeah, it's a time investment at this point. You're stuck.
That's right. But no, you know, what's been going on since last time? I mean, let's maybe start with... since it is a conservation podcast, mm-hmm. any habitat work going on here at the home place?
So haven't had a lot of time to take on any new big habitat projects. We will be, though, here pretty soon. Actually, so we had a forest management plan. I think we did talk about forest management mm-hmm. stuff a little bit in the last episode. The forest management plan only covers you for 10 years. And so that expired here in July of this year. And then we just had a consulting forester come out, mm-hmm. Meet with me and tour the property and kind of take a pulse on what's good and what's bad. What objectives did we meet through the first phase of work, and, you know, some really good stuff and some stuff that, like, we did a good job when we did the work. And then a couple of years later, we were hit with oak wilt. And yeah, we lost a lot of big mature oak trees. And so what took over after that was not good stuff. You know, mm-hmm. we did the right steps, but then nature threw us a curveball. Mm-hmm. So we'll be starting in again with a lot more TSI work here beginning part of this year and each of the next probably 7 or 8 years until we work all the way back through it again.
When you say we, do you mean you and your kids and your wife, or like, do you have a couple hired hands?
Past, when I said we, it meant me and the Dogwood crew, which we would typically hire 2 to 5 full-time employees from beginning sometime in mid-February and keep them through the end of September. And we would do comprehensive property management work for a lot of different landowners. And then once in a while, in between finishing one project and starting another, we would just work here for mm-hmm. a couple of days, and we'd just knock out the stuff that I needed to get done. And I have a crew that does that every day. So we would just do it.
Yeah.
Now when I say we, I don't have those employees. And so I guess I mean me and my boys. Get ready, kids.
That's what my dad said, meant when he said we for a long time. Yeah. Now it just happens to include Kent.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. My dad, the same. When he said I, it usually meant we. Yeah.
Or my grandpa was famous for being like, hey, we need to shovel out the snow in the front. And that did not mean we.
Nicholas, you need Nick, to can do you that. Tell us about a certain deal that you made the other day? You don't use names, but it's just one of my favorite stories.
So someone I was working with really didn't want to do a job. And this job involved shipping, and shipping is a nightmare when it comes to logistics. It's just terrible. And they said, how about this? I'll make you a deal. You do this.
Period.
That was the deal. And it took me a couple of minutes to figure out, like, oh, there wasn't a deal. I'm just going to do this.
Here's the deal.
So, it was not transactional.
End of sentence.
I now handle all the shipping.
I loved that. That made my day when I heard that, especially since it happened.
I'm going to use that on my kids for sure.
Kent loves my suffering. Yes. Like, I'll come in and be like, man, the tax man really killed me this year. Oh, like $100,000.
It's just so funny to me.
He'll just burst out laughing. He'll be like, oh, man, dude, you're suffering.
Because I know Nick will hack his way out of it.
Yeah. First world problems.
That's right.
We're not here to talk about my shipping problems.
Yes, yes. It's just a great sidebar.
So habitat, right? Habitat.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Habitat. So you got the forest management plan going.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind telling us, like, what some of the high points were that the foresters like, man, nice work.
We had really good success rate or survival rate on the 3-gallon oak trees that we planted.
Oh, very good.
During the different phases of work. So we did a lot of our timber was pretty poorly stocked with good quality trees. There were mm-hmm. some stands where we killed like 50%+ of the trees in the stand. It was just, it had been fenced. Let's say, I'm just guessing by the condition of the fencing around it, I'm going to say probably 40 to 60 years ago, somebody mm-hmm. ran a combination of cattle and hogs on this farm. And we know about the hogs because one of the neighbors down the road, his family used to own this ground, two owners before us. And so when he was in high school, yeah, we used to, all this now where it's prairie grass and buildings and stuff out here, they used to pick corn on it and then they would drag out their little, you know, the little triangular shaped, wooden hog sheds, the huts. Yeah. And, you know, they'd kick all the sows out here on the field over the winter. And so they kind of did a number on the timber, you know, they neutered the timber of oak regeneration. And so we just had a few like 80 to 150 year old, bur oak and white oak out there. And then there was, you know, you lost all of that regen over about a 40, 50, 60 year period. Yeah. So we were going in there and we planted, these 5, 6, 7 foot tall, 3 gallon containerized trees. And, am I allowed to plug a company that those
Absolutely.
Came from?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we order a lot of those through Forest Keeling Nursery, which is down in, I think it's Ellsbury, Missouri. It's
okay.
Kind of Hannibal area.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So you went a little ways to grab it.
Yeah. We'll go down there and, you know, we'll take an enclosed trailer down there and we'll pick up 700, 800, 1100, somewhere in that range. We can fit in a 16 foot trailer and, bring them home. And, so they're good value. I mean, you can do the same thing effectively if we had planted just like bare root seedlings, but we would have been planting, instead of planting like 32 to 36 per acre, we would have probably planted like 250 per acre.
Yeah.
And we, 10 years in, we would have been lucky to have about the same number survive.
Yeah.
So
what varieties did you plant out there?
We planted a lot of bur oak, a little bit of white oak, swamp white oak. We planted chestnut oak, and I snuck in a little bit of sawtooth just because I like them. My forester wasn't thrilled with me.
Like, those are pretty fast growing, right?
Yeah, so they are. And they put out an abundance. They're part of the red oak family. They put out an abundance of acorns, and turkeys really like them, and they're just a cool-looking tree. And so we planted a little bit of pecan. I didn't do any black walnut because we have a couple of different stands on our property that have quite a bit of black walnut. And that's not really a fantastic wildlife tree. So, you know, I wasn't really on a mission to try to grow a bunch of saw logs here. My primary objective was to make better quality wildlife habitat. So, you know, mostly white oaks, but we did put in a little bit of northern red, and then, you know, the sawtooth and chestnut oak, but, pretty much all native trees with the exception of the sawtooth and, stuff that our timber was, we had, most of those stands had 30 to 45% white oak in them. And then there was just a whole lot of low grade stuff after that. We had some honey locust. We had a lot of elm, a little bit of ash, which I don't have anything against ash other than they were all dying with the emerald ash borer, we were losing them all anyway. And then some like box elder and just, I mean, low quality stuff.
Hackberry.
Yeah. Plenty of hackberry. Yeah. And one stand that about 5 acres that was about 30 or 40% sugar maple, which my wife now, she at the time,
she
I kind of,
them?
No, they're dead. So I at the time I'm like, yeah, I don't really have any need for those. And then, you know, within a year or two after I killed them all, she's like, you know what we should do is we should tap some maple trees. And it's like, we don't have any maple trees. She's like, what do you mean? I thought we had a bunch of them. No, we don't anymore.
So, forest management plan took care of them.
That was one thing in our future homestead plans that we just had never discussed. It's cool when people tap maple trees, but gosh, you know, we have a lot of other irons in the fire. It just isn't something that I thought we'd ever get around to.
Yeah.
That's like a new level of, like my wife and I do a lot of construction work on houses. And, what color do you want the grout on the backsplash? Except for you guys, it's like, these 400 trees on these acres, which kinds do you want? It's like way bigger, scope on things. And, is that ever really, like, is that difficult? Do you guys ever have hard contention on what you're
No. So the only thing in developing our homestead that we ever had like a little bit of friction about was she was ready to have horses right away, I think. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we don't have any fencing. We don't have, you know, and we don't have a horse barn. And it was just, to me, it was more of an investment, more infrastructure that had to go in. And would I have liked to been able to just like snap my fingers and have all of that here, you know, day one for her? Yeah. You know, but, so it took me longer to get to those things. Hopefully not too long. I don't know. She would look back probably and say our kids were still pretty young at that point too. Mm-hmm. And so she was pretty tied up with, you know, spending a lot. They just were a lot needier, you know, at the early ages. And I think, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. So we both understood that, like, all right, we really need to focus on the things that take longer to mm-hmm. develop and do put those in motion first.
And that was mostly trees.
Yeah. It was planting hardwood trees. It was something that was like, you know, they take years and years to amount to much. Yeah. Like, we need to really focus on the condition of the timber, get those trees in the ground. And then we can just, then now they're kind of on autopilot. There's nothing more we can do for them. Either they're going to make it or they're not, you know?
Right.
But then things like, you know, building garden boxes and things like that, that our soil here is terrible. I mean, you know, this area has fantastic soil, but we bought the kind of ground that holds the earth together is what the farmers around here call it, you know? So they're like, oh, that's not good for anything, you know? So, it's low quality. This is a clay knob, you know, so it's pretty thin topsoil and pretty low PI and not a lot of organic matter.
It was farmed to death at one time, or do you think
I could speculate, but I would say it's definitely, if you look at the soil maps, we have some highly erodible land and it was tilled, it was farmed. And in the bottoms, we do have some really good, nice topsoil. Yeah. I wonder how it got there.
Yeah.
Right? There's a little bit of that.
The rest is in the Gulf of Mexico.
But there's also probably a lot to it that, it was probably timber. You know, to have that porous soil, like what we have here now that is prairie, historically, like if we rewound to pre-civilization days, it was probably all trees on all of this stuff. And the prairie was out there on the flat stuff that has 6 foot of black dirt under it.
Yeah.
And now that's all corn. So we plant prairie in, the marginal spots where there's not great soil. But
we're putting prairie where trees used to be.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, and that's part of the modified landscape going forward. You know, we just talked about that in the coffee time episode we did at the East Moline Rotary, but it's interesting to hear that land history and just where you guys are going with it, and it's a beautiful place out here, really, what you guys have put together. And I think something that's inspiring to anyone that pulls up here, and they're just wow, you know,
this is the ugliest time of year to see it, you know. I mean, it's
beautiful.
Usually at this time of year, our prairie grasses are still have some, you know, standability has been pretty good.
Yep.
We got 25 inches of snow in like 48 hours, and it was wet when it first started, so it stuck to the grass, and then the weight of all the other snow, it flattened it like a pancake.
Yep.
But you know, I've had a few people out recently that aren't familiar with prairie, or they haven't seen it when it's, you know, 6 or 7 foot tall. And they're like, wow, that's a lot of dead grass. They're like, what was that? What did you plant that for? And I was like, well, I showed them some photos, some video and stuff. Well, this is what it's going to look like again. What do you have to do to it to do that? It's like, light a match.
Yeah, that's right.
Light a match and wait about 7 weeks. It doesn't take long. It comes right back.
Yeah, ours is the same way at the farm. You know, it's just all laid flat. But it's been interesting to see, you know, from our perspective, because we have everything growing in monocrops. You know, you can see how different grass species, which is super helpful when we're talking to customers about their goals for their property. You know, I really want a good late season pheasant hunting spot or thermal bedding for deer or something like that. Okay, well, these are the species that hold up well to the snow. It's Sideoats grama. I don't know, Nick, have you looked over there at our Sideoats grama?
Straight up and down.
Yeah, it's held up very well. Yeah, little blue stem holds up pretty well.
I saw a TikTok video or something the other, or maybe it was an Instagram reel of you guys bagging Sideoats grama.
Yep.
Big old pile of it.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. I think Sideoats grama was in a severe lack this year. I mean, in years past, it would sell for $4 or $5 a pound. I sold some the other day for $38 a pound because we're almost out. Because most of the other big companies that do large amounts of Sideoats grama, I'm talking, you know, a few hundred acres of just Sideoats grama, the drought hit them so bad, they, you know, when they'd normally get 50,000 pounds, they might have gotten 10. You know, just really, really bad this year. But
yeah, it all changes every year, and that's you know, that can be frustrating, but it can also be encouraging, you know, when you see a good crop come in or something like that. But yeah, it flattens out and everything. But you guys still have a beautiful place out here, and spring is coming. It's coming fast.
I had a question about the flat prairie. Do your pheasants hang out still in the flat prairie?
They do. We've seen some pheasants the last 2 weeks just kind of running up and down the driveway, and you look out there and think, like, where are they hiding? Yeah. You know, I think this is where feathered edges come in so handy too, because right now you'll see them out in the prairie grass because they're out there kind of scratching around. They're picking up some seed and stuff, and they feed through it. But I think they're probably at least half the time they're nesting, or right now they're just, you know, hanging tight right along. Like we have some, let's just call it rough edges around the belt of timber that circles our prairie grass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of American plum in there and a lot of gray dogwood and stuff. So there's these thickets that I see them hiding in a lot. And we were walking through a couple of days ago shed hunting in part of the timber, and we flushed out a couple of pheasants like in the timber.
Wow.
But they they were within, you know, 40, 50 yards of the edge of it, on the edge of a fire break, but they were in the timber. And, you know, there's a little bit of lodging and stuff. So this is where I guess I would say switchgrass component helps a lot, because the parts of our property that do have some switch in it, which probably 75% of ours up here really doesn't have switch. But we do have a little bit on the hillside and stuff, and those, there's a little bit more lodging.
Yeah.
They kind of had maintained, you know, a foot, 18 inches of structure, and the other stuff canopied over the top of it.
Right,
and I'm guessing there's definitely some birds that go in and out underneath.
Yeah, those stems are very straw-like on switchgrass. It just, it's pretty tough stuff.
And there's like 40 of them per, you know, per clump. So it stays up.
Yeah, it does. We can't really see our switchgrass field from where we're at this time of year. It's way in the back corner of one of our farms, but I can tell you, when we harvest that field, we go over with a swather, and it leaves probably 2.5 to 3 feet of the stem, and we just take the tops off. It's just a sickle cut, you know. And a clutch went out on a steering clutch on our windrower a couple summers ago, and Carol and I had to crawl under that while, you know, this freshly cut switchgrass, and it was like laying down on punji sticks, man. it cut me through my pants and my shirt and stuff like that. But that stuff is just really durable, really tough stuff. And I would agree with you. That's a good wintertime, you know, thermal cover for ground nesters and for deer too, really. But yeah, and also the importance of incorporating not just, you know, it's easy for us just to talk about prairie, but it's a whole network of habitat. You know, those feathered edges are so important. Thinking of those shrubby species like you mentioned, and there's some there's some shrubby prairie forbs like indigo. You know, that makes a good edge feathering species too. Even though it kind of dries out, it's not as tough as like an American plum or a dogwood or something. It could still help with
give some structure,
right? Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. So yeah, great points there. You mentioned this a little bit, homesteading. So we're going to talk about the Land to Ground podcast, which is an awesome podcast. I've listened to almost every episode. I was listening to it like crazy this last week, and it just really, really made the days pass. I was like, man, it's already time to go home and just listen to your podcast.
Kent called me. He's like, hey, before we go and interview Chase, we should really listen to that podcast. And then the next time we had talked, I think on the phone, was like 5 hours later, both of us had listened to at least an episode and a half. I'd listened to an episode and a half. He'd listened to
I was at least three at that point.
Yeah, and we were like, this is really good. You know, it didn't just feel like homework at that point.
Well, yeah, and we'll talk about that in a second. But you mentioned in there, you interviewed your wife, Jackie. Mm-hmm. She did a great job, by the way. I know you said in there a few times this isn't her comfort zone, but she should do it more. It was good stuff.
She loosens up after a while.
Yeah.
It takes some people just a little bit, you know, to get in the zone and feel comfortable. And we do I think if we just recorded audio, it would probably not freak people out quite as bad. But when you have cameras and lights and stuff, nobody's comfortable. I'm not comfortable.
Yeah.
And this is just, it's a lot easier to speak naturally and ignore, you know, that you're you have an audience outside the person, one or two people you're talking to. But
right.
No, it's easy also for somebody to really open up and start talking about topics that's something that they just are super passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, so I knew she would be a great guest to have in there on that.
Well, she was so realistic in how she talked about it. Like she said, yeah, we would like to do this, but we don't have time for that right now. And so, you know, we're homesteading, but we aren't necessarily doing all the things that you see on TikTok and Instagram that, you know, the influencer homesteaders are.
You get inspiration from some of that stuff, but then, you know, you have to pick and choose what parts of it fit your lifestyle.
Exactly.
And how deep down that rabbit hole you really want to go. Like, are we trying to be completely self-sufficient here? No. I mean, we love the idea of that, but you know, we're not hermits and we don't homestead as full-time jobs, you know,
right.
To us, it's like, well, how much can we manage to do and what parts of it do we either find the most fulfilling?
Yep.
We just like for her, she said her garden, she just really, that's kind of her peace place, you know, when she's out there working in it, it's therapy, you know, it's fruitful. You're producing something for your table, for your family. So you get the benefits of it, but the psychological benefits of it are actually really rewarding too.
Yeah. Imagine if, so we have, what is it? 330 million people in the United States. You figure maybe we'll say a sixth of that would be like a leader in the household that's directly related to food acquisition and preparation for the family, maybe. So what's it? Nick, you're the math guy. 1/6 of 330 million.
330 million, 1/6, 16%.
Is that like 50 million, something like that, right?
I don't know.
A little times 50 and some change. 53 million maybe. But anyways, so imagine if you had 53 million meals less. So if you just grew enough produce to cover one meal, which let's be honest, out of a garden you probably get, out of an average sized garden, you probably get 20 meals.
55 million. Congratulations,
Ken. Wow, I'm taking over your job.
No, yeah, I would agree.
You know, if you had 53 million meals taken out of average family sized meals, taken out of like all the ugly side of the American food chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the driving tomatoes from California to Illinois and and you know, all the stats on how many miles does each piece of food that you're eating in this, you know, how many pounds of carbon is that in the atmosphere? If you were able to just
chemicals.
Cut that back by 50.
I was waiting to see if he was going to touch on that part.
Yeah,
too.
Agrochemicals, yeah. If you're able to cut back on 53 million meals worth of that, that's a significant, and I think that's an important part of that message of, no, we're not doing it full time, but we're doing it.
Every
period.
Little bit helps.
You're right. Every little bit helps.
For sure. I mean, the more we can remove ourselves from the food system, you know, the better, honestly, the more everybody benefits.
Yeah.
I mean, the more, the less waste there is, the more environmentally friendly our society is.
Health insurance would be cheaper for everybody. real, like there'd be less doctor's visits. And,
It's true.
No doubt about that.
Yeah.
So we're not as in a place where like if we could snap our fingers and if we could produce, let's say 60 or 70% of our food here on the property, would that, would we do it? Yeah, absolutely we would.
Yeah.
But there are seasons where like we eat a lot of fresh stuff, and then we freeze a lot of beef, a lot of chicken, a lot of venison. We're just not big pork eaters.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, otherwise, you know, I would say 95 to 98% of the meat that we eat on this property was raised on this property or by
our
hands.
Incredible. That's incredible.
Produce, we're probably like maybe 25 to 35%. There's, you know, in the summer when the garden's really rocking. Yeah. I mean, we're, you know, most of the greens or any of that sort of stuff that we cook and eat, it's stuff that we grew, but we're not that great at canning it, you know, freezing it and preserving a lot of that stuff.
Sure.
So for us, it's like, we're kind of seasonal on how much we end up going to the grocery store and buying a lot of that, you know, frozen veggies and that kind of stuff for the wintertime. But, you know, but you go through seasons of life too, where like we're learning how to do enough of that stuff that maybe, you know, in our retirement years or whatever, if it ever slows down a little bit, we'll take a little bit more time to do that. And when the kids are grown and they're out of the house, two things happen, you know. One, you have a little bit more time because you're not constantly chasing around to the next youth event or, you know, sports event or school stuff and just whatever. But then two, you have less help. So you kind of also pick and choose what chores, you know, how much do you enjoy weeding the garden without a couple of 10-year-olds to do it for you?
That's true.
That's a strong generalization though, because I grew up in a rural area, and the percentage of the people that I knew that actually helped their parents do stuff wasn't that high. And I'm not saying, I mean, I'm sure your kids help. I've heard your podcast. It's obvious they do some work, but I think for more people, getting less help or having less help is actually a smaller deal than them having more time. Mm-hmm. You know, they might lose a Saturday morning of help, but they're gaining every evening of the week that they don't have to chase someone.
No, you're probably right.
Well, but going to a homesteading model, and when I want to talk a little bit more about some of the other stuff you guys are doing, it helps bring that back alive though. You know, that more traditional small farm look, you know, where kids are gathering eggs and kids are pulling weeds and kids are helping pick beans and all that stuff. You know, I think where you have that buy-in system where it doesn't feel so separate from you, you know, somebody who's cash renting your acres to plant corn and soybeans, you feel zero connection to those corn and soybeans. You know what I mean? You just, not that it's wrong, but you're not, if you were to say to your, you know, your kids, hey, do you want to go help the renter, you know, with I don't know, detasseling or something like that, if they were had some test plots or something out there, and be like, what are you paying me? You know, like if you said, hey, do you want to go help pick, you know, some sweet corn for dinner this evening?
Yeah,
sure. You know?
Yeah. And Jackie hit on that in her podcast episode too, was talking about the elements of homesteading that are just easier to get the family involved with. Kids are always going to enjoy doing the stuff with animals more than they enjoy, you know, growing a garden. All of that stuff happens in slow motion. So it's hard for, you know, in a kid, everything happens so fast in their mind that putting seeds in the ground and spraying some water on, it's like, well, this is exciting. I'd rather watch paint dry.
Yeah.
Right. You know, but when you're, you know, feeding a baby bottle lamb or something, it's like, wow, this is fun. This is so cool. This is, you know, so it's easy to, you know, get kids involved in certain parts of it. And then other parts are just, they're just not, you know, it's not going to be their thing, but that's where we lean into, like, it's good to learn how to do hard things, and you also, they learn patience and they, you know, understand that, like, a lot of times you'll invest a lot of time into something that you won't see immediate fruit born from, you know, it takes not just within our own power either, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we incorporate a lot of, faith lessons into it. And it's just when you're being a steward of something, you're, being a caretaker and you're working in it, and you will only see eventually the benefit from it in God's timing.
Yeah.
So you can't make it. Yeah. You can't make that plant just start growing tomatoes.
Right.
You can water it. You can, you know, weed it. You can do all the right stuff, but that's going to happen when it's ready to.
You can't.
That's a good point.
You can't look at the story of the Garden of Eden where God put the first two humans and say, you know, I don't think God likes delayed gratification. It's like, no, you know, the first ever vocation involved delayed gratification. And frankly, it took me a long time to learn its importance. And I relearn it all the time.
Yeah. You know? I find that, so in the prairie business, I mean, you guys, when we plant prairie grasses, I was taught early on, and I've repeated this many times, like the sleep, creep, leap, the 3-year process of when you put prairie grasses in the ground. And because so many times when somebody plants their prairie and they're like, they want it to look like ours does at the end of the first summer.
Right.
And it's like, well, get ready for that not to happen.
Yeah, right.
if that's what it has to be for you, then maybe
so true.
Prairie isn't the right path. But.
Yeah. That's one of the hard that's one of the hardest sells on, especially like backyard prairie. People who care, they know and they get it. But, you know, if you're like, wow, it could be really beautiful, and you're selling someone on a new idea, or not even selling, like, you know, teaching them how it's a great idea. Hey, the one thing is, it's going to take 4 years. You know, and then, what? You know, well, it's going to take 4 years.
you know, a good thing, though, to keep in perspective is comparing that to planting oak trees.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
There, at least you'll see that in your lifetime, you know, whereas oak trees, I planted a bunch of oaks out on our family farm last spring with my kids. And while I was planting them, I was like, man, I hope Jonas gets to hunt these someday. Mm-hmm. You know,
because
I
won't. Well, when we planted the first lot of ours, I was thinking the same thing. I thought, I'll never hunt probably under one of these trees or hang a stand in it, but one of my kids might.
Yeah.
You know, they might end up with a tree stand hanging on one of these trees, which is,
that's really cool.
Yeah, it is cool. It's just, it's neat to put something in the ground that you don't expect to reap a harvest from. It's just that, like, it's a you start when you're managing hardwood timber. I said this in our last podcast, was that you have to train yourself to think in generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Bible says
that's a great way to view it.
A righteous man leaves inheritance for his children and his children's children.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a good person actually thinks in those terms, you know, not what can I get now for this year, next year, not even what can I get for my retirement, but what can I leave behind that is going to be meaningful and add value to their life. And that's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a good point.
What are you hoping that your kids get out of homesteading and being involved in it?
If there's a better way to foster a relationship with land than to have kids live on it, work on it every day, and engage in some recreational activities on it that excite them and just make them have a lot of fun, so it isn't all just work, work, work.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a better way to do that than living a homestead kind of field to fork lifestyle, I don't know what it is.
Mm. Yeah.
So I guess what I'm hoping they get out of it is that they may move out someday, go to college somewhere, get married, end up, you know, two states away, or they might end up living in a big city somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I expect that at some point in time, they'll have a longing to get back to a farm.
Yeah.
And, you know, they might go chase a dollar or chase a girl or something and end up somewhere pretty far from a piece of land at some point during their life. But I think that both of them will at least have a very healthy respect for it. And I imagine that by the time they start a family of their own, they'll start to feel like, this is not necessarily the life I want for my kids. Mm-hmm. I want my kids to grow up in a rural environment you know, to at least have those experiences that they had growing up.
That's a great point.
Unless you're like a totally two-faced person, which I don't think you are, you know, and you're anything like this at home, your kids are going to catch that really hard. And I'm very confident in their connection.
If you'd asked them just now without me in the room, what do you think your dad wants you to get out of this? I think they would have said pretty close the same thing. I mean, cool. They know how I feel about that, but it's, you don't force kids to love land, you know, and it's, you can't, it's like you want that for them. So at least that they respect it and they appreciate it. And, you know, every kid is wired so differently. Like ours are absolutely night and day different. They love doing a lot of the same things, but one of them is a bookworm and a technology whiz and just, you know, super, super smart kid. Does not love working with his hands. The other kid just wants to finish school as fast as he can and go live outside and get dirty and go, you know, he runs around most days with a pellet rifle and a 10 inch Bowie knife hanging off his belt. And you know, we joke about like, well, that kid might be hard to integrate into public school if we had to. I'm not sure how that would go. You know, but they do still enjoy the same things, and they both appreciate the same things. So, like when we cook a meal that is stuff that we grew, or you know, beef that we raised, or venison that one of them shot, you know, they all just like, they get excited about it. Both of them just absolutely love it, and they're like, "Does it get any better than this?" Like, there's people that are like choking down, you know, microwave dinners right now, at dinner time. And there's people that are hungry. And we talk about that quite a bit. And we've never, like, they don't know what it's like to be hungry. And we keep reminding them of that. And we're like, hopefully we never do know what it's like to be hungry. But just know that, like, we always have good quality, healthy food and an abundance of it because God blesses us that way. But it's the fruit that is born from us taking care of the land the way that we do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's another thing in there, too, that it's just important that we always have people that understand and possess those skills. We interviewed Matt Hatala from Ancestral Farms, Iowa. He's doing paddock grazing hog operation in kind of north central Iowa. And he didn't grow up on a farm. He talked about this in the interview that we had with him, where his best friend was having health issues related to the food that he was consuming. And he started doing some research on his condition. And he's like, man, we got to get away from this part of the food chain, or both him and his brother. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could do something about it ourselves. And he's like, well, how about we start raising our own protein? And so that's what they did. They started a hog farm. And he's like,
whole hog.
That's right. They went whole hog. And he's had to consult with people all over the country just to find the skills that it takes to do this. And so when you're teaching your kids on how to grow their own food, whether it's protein or produce, or harvest their own food through hunting, you're preserving those skill sets that, heaven forbid, the food chain that we have now cease to function as it does, we will definitely need people knowing how to get food the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. You're almost archiving that skill set to be carried on for more and more generations. And I think there's a lot of value in that. I oftentimes think, in my role at Hoxie, how lucky I am to be learning all the farming concepts from Carol, and how much I wish I could take from my grandfather's memory of how he farmed, starting back in the 30s, all that information that's still very relevant, and just understanding, about farming and how valuable that information is, but isn't so far from being lost either, if it's not transferred on. So I think that that's a huge part of incorporating your kids into what you guys are doing here on your acreage, So we've talked about it, Land Your Ground, new podcast that launched. You were just talking about this in the very early stages last time we were here.
Yeah, I was picking your guys' brains.
Yep, we got off the air and you're like, hey, I'm just thinking about this idea. And we told you some stuff on equipment and what we were using and so forth. And, man, you already got like 9 or 10 episodes published at this point, since that time.
Yeah. We're in a routine now where every other week, I would love to push out a new episode every week. It's not my full-time job.
Yeah.
So I'm, but the Land Your Ground basically is, something, an idea that was born between Jackie and I, and we talked about for a long time. It was like, is it related to real estate? Yeah, it is, because we're teaching people how to become landowners, and the people who are landowners, we're sharing their land stories. Mm-hmm. And we're, basically what can be gleaned or learned from people that, like, how did they grow their farming operation over the years or multiple generations, or some of the guests we're having in are going to be first time, land buyers. Mm-hmm. They may be their grandparents had a farm or whatever, but for them, it would have stopped there if they hadn't stepped up and bought their first piece of land type thing. So, I love the part of my job that I think I enjoy probably most as a land broker is when I go meet with landowners for the first time. I get to hear, because they're on the cusp of either making a major decision to sell a piece of property, or they're thinking about buying something. Either way, they're weighing that really heavily. And so they share with me the story about, like, their farming operation. And well, my granddad started with this 80 here, and then we picked up this piece, and we used to have a hog building over there. And then in the 80s that tanked us, and we almost didn't make it. And, you know, and they spill their stories out on me. And I just like, man, I love it. I mean, I let, you know, you can just, you get to hear the joys and the sorrows of farm life and, you know, how much it shaped those people, and then like how much, why it's so important to them that they're still, that their kids still have land, or that, you know, anyway, so for years we talked about that and said, we need to come up with some kind of a program that gives us a way to share some of those types of stories for future generations. And even just for those people's families to go back and watch years later and whatever. But then we also have a big heart for helping younger people. I'm 40 now. But, you know, we bought this farm when Jackie and I were 25, just turning 26 years old. Mm-hmm. And, it was a massive goal of ours. And we didn't, you know, there was a lot of people telling us that we wouldn't be able to do it. You know, we didn't, neither one of us came from any money. And it was like, you know, that's, you guys probably need to just aim a little lower. That was our circle, but those are, and they think they meant well, but they wanted to encourage us. But at the same time, they were not very supportive or helpful, with the exception of Jackie's folks, telling us that, you know, and my folks sold real estate at the time, but they're like, you really want to do that? I mean, my dad was our broker. He helped us buy this piece, and he still was kind of like, I'm not sure what you're going to do with it. I mean, that's a lot of money to, you know, anyway. Yeah. So we think about young kids like that, and, you know, just younger people, because the price of land has not gone anywhere but up since then.
Yeah.
And it's not getting any easier for those people to get started. So, you know, that's partly where the name came from. It's just, you know, it's just to send the message out that that's kind of who we're here for, is helping people land their ground, right? So people who have that dream of land ownership, we want to keep that dream alive and well. And we're just trying to educate and inspire people, and then lead them down a path that helps them get there.
Yeah,
yeah, love that. That's a great theme.
I'm wondering, so let's say someone, I'm 26. Let's say you were talking to me and I wanted to buy, me and my wife, let's say we wanted to buy some land out here. At what point would you tell them, hey, you need to go make some money. You need to,
you're not ready.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not. How do you deliver that message to people?
Truthfully.
Yeah. Cause I imagine tons of people in the community look up to you and they say, all I want is to buy some land. You know who the person to talk to is? Chase, let's go out there. You talk with them. And then you have to say like, I want to help you, but you're not, how does that go?
So I generally try to lay out options, and there's a lot of paths to land ownership. So we talk, you know, we do have to talk about their personal finances and where's their money going, and, you know, how much savings do they have, or what does it actually cost to buy a piece like this? What is it? How much money do you have to put down on it? And what's the monthly payment going to be? And then just what are the other ownership costs just to carry it? And what do you want to do with it? And what do you want your life to be like outside of owning this piece of ground? Because it's one thing if there are some people who are mentally devoted enough to the task of buying a piece of property that they will make real sacrifices and, you know, they'll sell the side by side, or they'll, you know, get rid of some of the things that the non-essential, you know, assets that they might have, and to free up the money to initially buy something like this. But then if you look at it and say, well, you're talking about wanting to buy an 80 acre farm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, here's a range that 80s are kind of bringing in this area that look like what you want. And here's what the monthly payment on it after the down payment would probably be. Here's how much revenue they can produce. And we do the math on it, but we don't focus a lot on that. That part happens pretty fast, but it's like, this is what you would have to come up with monthly to be able to own that farm.
Yeah.
And we look at how much they make, and we're just like, even in some cases it's like, okay, that's doable, but barely. And the bank might go along with it, but your debt to income ratio, you know, so what are some things we can do to,
where it's like, banks
right.
Like,
you either need to, a couple options, then it's like, well, you either need to be more patient and wait until your income increases some, or until you have more money to put down on it, or you stop thinking about that 80 and we look for a 20 or a 40-acre piece. Yeah. And we buy what's called a starter farm. You know, get into something that's land ownership. It gives you a lot of the gratifying effects of owning a piece of property. You're getting to work on something with that you own with your own two hands. And you can drive some appreciation into it because it's easier to force appreciation into smaller pieces. You pay a little bit more of a premium price per acre when you buy them, but you can, you know, do some land improvement stuff to them. Yeah. You know, you can add value to those pieces faster. And then 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we can sell it and roll that into a bigger piece. So I think the other part that, you know, when we bought this farm, I was that kid. I wanted 120 to 160 acres. Like I knew anything less than 100 was just not going to be big enough. And I was just, you know, I was like, I don't know how to make that happen, but this piece checked all the other boxes. It was in the right area where we wanted to be geographically. It was, you know, I mean, proximity to work, proximity to family, proximity to, it was in the right school district. It was at the end of a dead end road. We loved that it had good views. It had some open ground, but it was mostly timber in it. Everything that we wanted, but it was 55 acres. And I just was like, it's not big enough. if the price had been higher, like, honestly, I knew at the time that we were on the cusp of making a big jump in recreational land values. And I just, it was priced slightly under market. And I knew that. And I was like, that's just too good of a deal to pass. Like, even despite me thinking it wasn't big enough, it was like, I talked myself into it. And Jackie was like, it's plenty big. It's plenty big. Well, I knew that we were also getting ready to start a family. You know, I mean, we had just had our first kid by the time we bought this. And I thought, well, it probably is big enough for me, but it may not be big enough for me and multiple other kids and you that want to hunt on it and whatever. It's just, you could wear out a small tract pretty fast. Right. So, anyway, I'm rambling on that, but I think the story that I'm going to tell them is familiar to me because I lived it, you know, I think it's just understanding that they just need a coach to show them multiple different paths. And there are some to get there quickly. You might have to take some major drastic action. You might have to really get serious about selling some of these, you know, what do you have money tied up in that is not getting you to your end goal?
Right.
And you know,
what are some, you've had to hit a pretty common list of things that get in the way of young folks buying
a new truck,
land. What? Well, yeah. Just give us like your top five.
Okay. Expenses. Oh man. Top five is two or more car payments. This one's going to hurt a lot of people.
Go for it. It's our podcast. So people get mad at us.
Travel ball. People who have young kids spend an exorbitant amount of money chasing softball, baseball, basketball schedules
for the hopes of D2 playing.
Yeah.
D2.
Yeah, I mean, with the intent that, you know, best. And this is gonna, you know, I don't want to rant on that.
Spend $200,000 for a $40,000 scholarship.
Let's just put it that way. Like, I'm not making this up, and it's not just because, well, Chase is just anti-sports or whatever. I see it as a dream crusher for a lot of people. It is one of the things that trips them up and keeps them from achieving their rural home ownership or their land ownership dreams.
I never would have guessed. Yeah.
It's something that, because once you start into that with your children, it becomes a inescapable vortex.
Yes.
The better they get at it, the older they get, the more involved they get, and the more leagues that they get into, and they go from doing, well, it was just 6 games and then it became 18 games and now we're going to 34 games a year and we're traveling to, you know, 14 different cities and, you know, we have X number of hotel stays every year and it's, you know, 6 different uniforms. And
then not just one kid, but
you did it for one kid. Are you not going to do it for the second and the third kid? And
have you ever had to have hard conversations with your kids about
Don't interrupt the list.
I only gave two. Yeah. Two's enough. We can move on. Yeah.
Look, I worked at a hotel where I dealt with the parents of travel and they weren't all horrible, but some of them were real hard to be around.
Well, yeah, they're not happy to be there. The kid's not happy to be there, but it's the vortex.
It's a stressful situation for everybody a lot of times. But,
all right. Yeah, I don't need to answer my question. What are the last three?
Oh, gosh. In general, spending habits would be like eating out too much, liking to take expensive vacations. We're going to bundle all of that into one thing.
Sure.
Where they've become Well, so there's a term Jackie likes to use. It's called lifestyle creep. Mm-hmm. The more money you make, the more easy it is to spend it. And so you go from, well, we were making, you know, $60,000, you know, for our household income when we first got married or shortly after, whatever. And then within a few years, you're making 100, and then you feel like you're a big shot because we're in six figures now. And then, you know, and then the difference between, you know, the people who make $100,000 and the people who make $200,000 a year, a lot of them at the end of the year, neither one has any more money in the account than the other.
Yeah.
Because they've found lots and lots of ways to spend it throughout the year.
Parkinson's law. Humans use the resources available to them, whether it's space or time or,
money. Natural resources and money.
Yep. Gosh, I don't know. If I had to pick three more or two more, I mean, that's there's a lot of different reasons.
Toys got to be on there somewhere, right?
Oh, for sure. You know, and if we separate that out from just the lifestyle stuff, people, you know, that I hear a lot of times where people says, I just can't afford that land. It's just, you know, it's a rich man's game now. It's just cost way too much. But they have, you know, a brand new Can-Am sitting in the third stall of their garage. And they have a ski boat that they only used one time last year, or they've got, you know, some of them will have like a $130,000 RV sitting behind the shed.
Yeah.
And that, guys, that'll almost buy you a small farm. I mean, there's a lot of things that we feel like we need that, if that's really what brings you joy and that's, you know, that important to you and you're, you know, I subscribe to the philosophy too, that life is short. You only live once. So, you know, it's okay to enjoy some things and, you know, have a lifestyle that brings you happiness because it's fleeting, you know, but at the same time, if your dream is bigger than you, if it's about your family tree, and if you're trying to buy a farm because you want your kids and your grandkids and your great grandkids to have those types of experiences and that connection to nature and that connection to land, then you have to get really serious about that goal. And that means being willing to say those other things are ephemeral. They're not that important. You know, I can, and if I want to sell an RV so that I can cash in and take that money and put it down on a farm, I can always buy another RV 10 years down the road or 3 years down the road or whatever. Like those are replaceable things. You got to think bigger than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really important to have that conversation, even though it does step on toes, you know, it steps on my toes in some ways. Right. I think it probably, if you went down that list that Chase gave us, I think 99% of people listening into this could probably say, that area applies to my, where I, a weakness in my financial planning. And so
Kent's embarrassed to bring up his stamp collection. He spent thousands every year on his stamp collection. He's like, man, my toes are so stepped on right now.
Nick, I'm going to tell everyone about your Pokemon card collection.
I don't. They're too expensive and I want land.
But no, it's a great conversation to have. So a thing I wanted to ask you relating to the podcast, two things. One is just a totally out there, like a topic that got brought up in a interview you did. But and we're just going to spitball on that.
Yep. Okay.
But another thing is the best part of doing a podcast is the learning aspect. There is not, in my opinion, right now, there is not a more efficient way to learn than through podcasts, either listening or recording them. Mm-hmm. I think YouTube is up there for sure, but you have to be invested into YouTube. You know, like a podcast, man, I've gone through thousands of hours of podcasts just while doing other things, you know, like put my AirPods in and I'm like yesterday I was cleaning Sky Blue Aster, you know, so super efficient way to learn. What have you been learning through these first 10 or so episodes that you've recorded? Like, what are just some maybe general concepts or maybe some specific things that you've learned from your guests?
So, there are certain episodes where I feel like I've learned a ton, and then other episodes where, because the early episodes, you guys know this, when you first start a podcast, you kind of start with your tight circle. You start with people that you already know well enough or that they're comfortable enough. You ask them and they're going to say yes to come on. Right.
Yep.
Well, I'm lucky that, some of the people who are in that circle with me are, you know, landowners and have really cool stories and just, you know, they're interesting people to hear from. But I think I learned, a lot from Kim Sheese's episode. To me, that one was like, I know just enough about this stuff with soil science and regenerative ag and that sort of thing that it's something I'm really interested in, but I'm also still pretty naive about and pretty dumb on some of the topics. So I was like, really got a lot out of that. And that one, that one sent me and another one of our previous guests, when he watched that episode, man, and he farms, but he went and did a deep dive into regenerative ag and really started going down the rabbit hole. And he was like, I'm changing all kinds of things.
That's awesome.
Like, yeah, it is awesome.
I mean, that's the goal, right?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I think the conversations that that we have leading up to an episode, and then I learn probably as much after we push out an episode from talking to people who heard it, and then they ask me about it, or they've got a story they want to tell me because of this topic that we touched on, and then I just like sit back and listen, and I don't have to like worry about steering a conversation or asking the right questions. It's like, no, they heard enough to now they want to tell me something. And, I really, really have enjoyed that a lot. But I think what your point on how much you can learn from podcasts, or why podcasts are such a great educational tool, is just because there's like, it's a throwback to how people have always learned for, you know, thousands of years.
Yeah, that's true.
Video is a really super powerful tool, but like, person-to-person conversation, and when you're like behind the lens, or if you're, you know, just listening with the earbuds in while you're doing work or something, you feel like you're a part of the conversation, right? So everybody that's hearing us right now feels like they're sitting here with us, which is awesome. And I think you just you absorb the information a lot more, and you feel engaged in it, and then it's you and I, like, we can have an idea of where this conversation is going, but we really don't have a, you know, it's not scripted, so we really have, you never know what's going to come up or come out, and what information or something that you're going to drop some knowledge bomb on me that I would have never expected. So
That's why we always tell our guests, right? And we told you this, you have permission to talk about what you want to talk about, because it's a conversation and it's not like a show. We're not putting on a show with a bunch of monkeys and like, wow, look at how impressive this human is. It's more like, this person's very impressive because they have so much to teach. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. We got to be cognizant of our time here.
I know, Ken. I think we're at the end.
There's so much more I want to cover.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions.
I want to cover two more things.
Okay.
First of all, the spitball thing. We don't have to spend much time on this because it's all speculation. But you brought up something very interesting that I have been talking about with a very good friend of mine, and I've talked a little bit about with Carol, and I think, Nick, you and I have had a couple conversations on this. What are the long-term effects of all of this field tiling work that's going on?
I know. I was almost reluctant to bring that topic up because I didn't know where that conversation would go either. I've been thinking about that for probably close to 10 years. The more pattern tile that we see go in all of these farm fields every year, the more concerned I become about that. Because I don't know. I mean, what I believe is that it circumvents an important part of nature, which is the water cycle. You know, land is supposed to be basically a sponge, a reservoir that catches water as it falls, absorbs it, the plants use it, and then as it perks down, it's a natural filter. Water makes its way down through sediment layer after sediment layer until eventually it replenishes our aquifers. But it purifies the water. And when we put all this tile in, it's basically making it through the first couple of feet of soil, and then it ejects it out and dumps it into the nearest ditch, and down the Mississippi River it goes. That can't be good. I mean, I don't talk about that a lot because I think that, you know, farmers,
if you own farmland, you have tile.
And have for a long, long time. And they'll just say, well, it's not nothing new. We've been tiling fields for, you know, 100 plus years now. Well, kind of. I mean, the old clay tile was not nearly as fast at draining a field as as what we're doing now. And the amount of lineal foot or miles of tile that's going in, these 40 foot on centers versus, you know, you used to put a clay tile or two in a field, you know, and they're, you'd put it in the really low spot or the really wet spot as a sort of conduit, an artificial duct to move some water from a overly saturated spot. And now it's everywhere. And it's, it definitely changes not just soil chemistry, but it's, you know, when most of the surface area, most of our land in the Midwest becomes pattern tiled, that's gonna change a lot.
Yeah. Right.
You know, in our natural system, and I don't know what's gonna come of that, but yeah. I'm worried yeah. about it, to be honest with you.
I suspect that we will eventually find out that the amount of tiling that's been done, especially since 2020, a lot of tiling's been done. If you just look around, I think that has to do with some of that money we were talking about earlier. I suspect that our severe droughts that we have been experiencing year upon year upon year now in the Midwest are related to our exportation of our surface water that you're talking about. Mm. That water is being exported off of the landscape almost as fast as it arrives. And those wet spots, which is like the very scientific term, right? That's been used for so long. Oh, that's a wet spot over there. You know, those wet spots that were farmed around and had to be left alone or turned into ponds, or were just part of pastures where a cow would occasionally get stuck or something. Those have been drained almost everywhere. Those have been drained, and that was where we were storing local water. You know, like there's people think of the water cycle in a global sense, but there is a local sense mm-hmm. to the water cycle as well. And when all of our rainwater that we do get, and less frequently but in greater quantities all at once, when that doesn't have a chance to linger around in these wet areas anymore, it's not evaporating back up locally to replenish, you know, what we have stored in the air to precip and fall back to the earth.
Yeah.
And I'm not a meteorologist. I've taken classes in meteorology. I used to be a science teacher, but I suspect that is something we're going to start associating with droughts eventually as we get more data on this. And like you said, it's not a new concept. There's so much old, what do they call it? Red bird, clay tiles. Isn't that what its nickname was or something? There's so much of that at my house, old field tile that we've, you know, it's been pulled up through the years. And I think there was even a time my grandpa was telling me about this. I think it was during World War II. It was cheaper to use, to make like concrete tiles, but they found that those things were just like disintegrated after a few years or something like that. But you know, now with all this corrugated plastic tile that we have, I think that it's just so efficient at shedding water.
Yeah. And cheap to make it.
Right. Very and cheap to make it, very yep. And easier to put in. You know, you're not fitting every 4-foot section together. You know, you're able to lay down, you know, long stretches of it.
I think they can pull it in now. I'm pretty sure they can get a bore system where yes. they just pull it in and they don't even have to dig up the ground anymore.
Yeah. But yeah, it's an interesting thought, and stay tuned on it. And that's a lot also to a point of my friend who was really bringing this up to me, is that's a lot of plastic going in the ground. And we might say, no big deal. Okay. Go buy an old landfill and tell me that's no big deal. You know, it's a lot of plastic in the ground there that you're going to be concerned about. You know, you're not going to want to grow your garden on a, you know, on an old landfill. Why? Because of what's under the ground, right? Well, we're putting plastic all over the place under the ground. And what's that going to mean? I don't know. Plastic degrades, though, in our environment over time. And we know the story of microplastics ending up in ocean water and so on and so forth. So I don't know. I think I'm not going to make any accusations, but I am willing to make some predictions that it's going to come up. And we've talked about this before, Nicholas, when Chase used the term whole hog earlier. When we go whole hog into something like asbestos, lead, all these things that we've used mm-hmm. in the past.
Mercury pills.
Yeah, right, mercury. And then all of a sudden we find out, wow, literally every fish on the planet now carries mercury. And, you know, asbestos is never good for you, you know. And wow, I guess they shouldn't have made George Washington's dentures partly out of lead. That probably wasn't good. You know, like we laugh and chuckle at these things, but we go whole hog into these other adaptations all the time with these mm-hmm. different materials. And I don't know. I'd say stay tuned on that. We don't know what it'll be for a while. We might not know in our lifetimes, but I think there will be something on that. Okay, finally, last thing.
Yep.
Looming land transfer. We're seeing it pop up in the news. Landowners are getting
like 5 minutes over.
I know. I know.
Kids,
I just
like, bring it up. I'm gonna
try and wrap it up quickly.
Yeah.
I know. We could do a
Let's
whole.
Let's see how fast I can dump out that whole can of worms.
That's right. That's right. We keep hearing about how the average age of a landowner in America is gone up and up and up.
Yep.
We don't live forever. There's a lot of, you know, the boomers are a very large part of our population. They're getting older as well. And even those in the generation before boomers, I think it's a silent generation. Those people are in the golden years, right? They're going to be passing away soon. This land's going to be shifting around. Who are going to be the winners and losers, do you think? And how can our listeners win?
Oh man. It's a big question. So winners are going to be investors, corporations who want to go heavier into farmland ownership because there's going to be a lot of buying opportunities for them.
Just for the record, that's what I said. I just want people to know that.
Losers are going to be, by and large, the family farm operations that aren't prepared for that, which honestly is probably, maybe not a majority, but probably close to half. Mm. I think there are a lot of family farm operations that don't do nearly enough estate planning or that don't talk about succession within their land ownership, their farming operation. Farmers are notorious for never going to the doctor and always acting like they're going to live forever. Mm-hmm. And by and large, I mean, statistically, their lifespan is shorter than the average American.
Really? I did not know that.
They for a lot of different reasons, which would take us a lot more time to talk about. But I guess I would say is how do they make sure they're on the winning side of this? Then they need to get real within their family. If your family is a family of landowners, you guys need to be having like healthy conversations about how do you preserve that? How do you take care of it? How do you set up, whether that's taking action now to set up family trusts, or even just discussing like, okay, there's three siblings in this family. One of them works on the family farm. The other two have moved off and gone to town. But when mom or dad passes away and all of this wealth that's inherited is held in the form of farmland, how does one sibling buy out the other two for their share so that they can continue on with the farm?
For $4 million or some outrageous number,
Right. And they're just like, well, that land's worth a lot of money. I just want the money. I don't farm. I understand, right? I mean, it's all, those are concepts that everybody understands why it happens, but if you want something to change or for something to work out in the favor of maintaining, you know, interfamily land ownership, then you got to do some real planning and you can't wait until somebody kicks the bucket to start talking about that stuff or taking action. So I think the earlier they start really meeting with somebody, a financial planner or an estate planner, and then talking with their banker and their, you know, financial coach to just basically understand what do I need to do over the next 10 years or 15 years to make sure when the time comes, my dad's ready to retire, grandpa passes away or whatever happens, that I'm in a financial position that I can do it. Yeah. Those are the people the people who prepare, those are the people who are going to win. Mm. The unprepared are going to lose family farm ownership and, to the victor go the spoils, I guess, but there will be a lot of continued growth in corporate farm ownership. You know, smaller family farms continue to consolidate and be bought out by bigger family farms, and eventually corporations will buy out a lot of them and will probably control a lot of our agricultural commodities. And how much time do we have?
Start
getting into automated farm equipment.
We know what we need to talk about next year on our Illinois tour.
Yeah,
that's what we'll start out with. But see, Nicholas, we could
end on a higher note, right? Yeah. Well, I think the other trend that is also happening is that while farms are getting bigger, all these farms are absorbing more acres and trying to grow their footprint, There are other tracts of land. We're seeing a lot of like 160s to 380 acre tracts that are being sold as two or three different parcels. And it's opening up buying opportunities for some of these smaller, younger buyers or people who are, you know, using the land in unique ways or like have a niche rather than just like traditional row crop or whatever. And so we're seeing quite a few of these pieces where when somebody passes, if they have multiple holdings, it isn't typically, at least today, all one buyer that gobbles up all that land. A lot of times if it was under one ownership and now it's under two or three or four. Mm-hmm. So
interesting.
That is an interesting trend too. This is partly where our focus is right now. It's like how these people who aren't landowners right now, but want to become that, how do we coach them up and how do we get them prepared, ready so that they can achieve that dream? Because those opportunities are going to be there. There's going to be a lot of land that changes hands.
Yeah, man, that was such good advice.
This is not good. I got more questions than I
We got to come back.
We'll do another one. Back.
Oh, yeah, man.
That's right.
I had an amazing time.
Yes, this was a really useful podcast. Please tune in to Land Your Ground because I think that helps you be a winner in the looming land transfer. You get some of this good advice and look at the list of things that are, the painful list that Chase gave us that oftentimes disqualify people from being able to make a move when they want to make a move. And, you know, do that self-evaluation a little bit. And that's important to do anyways. So great stuff. Thank you, Chase, so much for coming back on our show. And you want to plug anything real quick besides the podcast?
How can people find you?
So they can find me on Land Your Ground if they're interested in buying or selling real estate. I'm with a brokerage called Land Guys. And you know, we specialize in rural properties. About a third of what I sell is homes on acreage. A third of it would be row crop or ag production type ground. A third of it is recreational land. So I can help anybody that's looking for that type of dirt in this area. But just reach out, shoot me a message. Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. You can find Land Your Ground on any of those. And I check those messages all the time. So
awesome. Something that is very obvious about, you're not just a help buy, sell. You're a coach. And coaches are great, but it's obvious Chase has very aligned values with many of our listeners. And so, you know, just any old broker, great. We have friends that are brokers and agents and that's good. But if you're looking for someone that has aligned values that can help you get an outcome you want, Chase is an awesome place to be. And a guy that Kent and I love picking his brain. So.
Yeah,
appreciate
definitely.
That.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Remember, this podcast is presented by Hoxie Native Seeds. Still plenty of time to get stuff purchased for this spring. There's still some people planting now. We just planted some last week. But those temperatures are rising, so your cold strat might have to take place in your refrigerator at this point. But if you need any CRP for this spring, you know who to call, or backyard pollinator, whatever. Hunting mixes, habitat mixes. Just because you like it, Prairie, we can help you with that. Go to HoxieNativeSeeds.com or ThePrairieFarm.com to get your seed. And remember, just like we're learning from Chase in this episode, conservation happens one mind at a time.